welcome to this edition of Club Talk, the new club's fortnightly podcast. Today I have the pleasure of interviewing Professor Robert Arnott, a distinguished academic, archaeologist, sometime NHS general manager, and in his early years, you were with the civil service. So Bob and his wife Tricia have been members of the club for around 5 years, I think, having moved to Cheltenham from Birmingham. You came to Cheltenham many times, I think, in connection with research with Holly Marklew, also a distinguished archaeologist and a member of the club. So welcome, Bob. There's so much to talk about, from your early days in the civil service to your current work studying the origins of medicine in the ancient world. So let's start at the beginning. You originally joined the civil service in Edward Heath's era, and I'm sure you've got many a tale to tell of those early days.
Yes, I have indeed. I graduated from University College London and joined the civil service in 1972 and worked my way up. I was an administration trainee and I had to do my stint in private office like you all do, because you do a sort of rotation for part of your training for when you're going to be a permanent secretary, which of course I never was, but my colleague was. I've got a number of tales to tell. I mean, I was the lowest of the low in many terms, because I was what they call the bag carrier. But being Keith Joseph as my minister or Secretary of State, I had to sit in the back of his car with him on a number of occasions. He was an extremely intelligent man, and you had to try and keep up with the conversation. Some of it got a bit weird at times. We all know Sir Keith's history. But I've got two particular stories I love to tell about my days in the civil service. One was, I was duty officer one night, sitting there in front of this sort of telephone you see on James Bond novels, you know, a grey telephone with a red receiver. And it rings, and it was Lady Joseph on the phone from their home in Holland Park. And she said, I've got a problem. I said, what's that, ma'am? She said, I've got social security claimants chain themselves to our front railings. What do I do? And I said, oh, right, leave it with me. I'll ring Cannon Road Police Station there and I'll get it sorted out. Oh, thank you very much, Bob, she said. I've given them tea, which amused me greatly. It wouldn't happen today. And it was a sort of an indication of the noblesse oblige that, you know, existed in those days. My other great, even better story in many respects, was on our floor was all the senior medical staff. We had the chief medical officer, Sir George Godbury, and his staff, you know, two deputy chief medical officers, four assistant chief medical officers, principal medical officers, senior medical officers, the chief dental officer and his staff, the chief nursing officer and her staff. And I was the first aider. And I think that said more about our political medicine than anything. This poor AT had to bandage up and do headaches, whereas very senior doctors with fellows of the Royal College of Physicians didn't want to know. I find it was amusing. I spent many happy years in the civil service, 4 years to be precise, and then I moved to Birmingham. There are opportunities opening for a new structure within the National Health Service. And it's something I wanted to do. I'd worked in divisions of the NHS and the HSS headquarters, and it particularly interested me and my passions for things like this. So I went up to Birmingham and joined the new structure within the NHS there, and soon rose after a few years to be a district general manager.
You ended up, I think, there as general manager.
I did indeed.
That started your real interest in health. Well, it started at the civil service, but then it became a very enduring passion.
That's absolutely right. I mean, two things, really. Firstly, my degree was in archaeology, ancient history and archaeology. So, I've got the background there. But also, my interest in the NHS not only was professional, it was personal, because my first of my great illnesses, Crohn's disease, started happening at that time. And I was in and out of hospital for a while. And then, you know, that helped develop that passion for health. Yes. But when you're running in the NHS, you haven't got really time for funny stories, because a lot of it wasn't particularly funny. I spent my whole time fighting cuts, having my budget reduced slowly and every time. The problems of the government policy towards the end, care in the community. I one of my biggest hospitals was an 800-bed hospital, mostly full of the elderly, mentally ill, and they were to be dispersed and nursing homes up and down the road between Erdington and Sutton Coalfield, and their treatment, I was convinced, I did some inspections, was going to be a lot worse than they would have got as an inpatient hospital. So, I mean, there was a lot of problems there, and when I was having discussions with my colleagues in the Department of Ancient History and Archaeology at Birmingham University, I used to sneak off there for seminars. Told them I was at the regional health authority headquarters, a serious meeting, and then go to a seminar at the university.
Let me just interrupt you there, because I think that you're working toward a real change of direction, a really important change of direction. When you left the health authority, you went back to academia and you combined that knowledge that you had of healthcare together with your other great passion, which was your love of archaeology. And you went in Birmingham to become the Professor of History and Archaeology of Medicine at the University of Birmingham. And then other really important appointments followed, including that of Fellow of Green Templeton College, Oxford University, an appointment that you still hold today. So, Bob, for those of us that are not familiar with your field of expertise, archaeology, can you explain how you go about detecting complex historical medical data?
Effectively, there's three ways of finding the evidence for ancient medicine and disease. The first one is texts, the classical texts of Galen, Hippocrates, Theophrastus and others. And then, of course, the texts that are brought out from the Near East with clay tablets, cuneiform clay tablets that tell us a lot, Egyptian papyri that tell us a great deal. Some of the most wonderful medical texts are, in fact, Egyptian. But that's just one side of it, because that needs to be corroborated with archaeology. A text can mention a particular instrument. Sometimes you take a so-and-so and use it, and we need to find out what that instrument was. So there's archaeology, and you can have surgical instruments, you can have pottery, and you can do an organic residue analysis and pottery to find out what they contain. And sometimes they contain remedies. I did a lot of work on an Eastern Crete on that some time ago, looking for the medicines that the copper smelters were using as they were gradually poisoning themselves with arsenic. And then the third part is, and the one I'm particularly interested in, is human remains, skeletons mostly. Outside Egypt, we get very little soft tissue, but of course in Egypt we have the mummies, which can tell us a great deal.
So you're talking about bones and skeletons. So just go on a little bit more about how you deal with that and how you do find evidence.
It's complicated, and the evidence isn't complete, because where you have only bones and no soft tissue, your evidence is limited, in as much as it's only chronic disease, not acute disease, leaves on the body. But we can find out about trauma. We can find out about how trauma was treated. We can find out about some diseases that leave markers. Some tuberculosis can leave marks on the bones, leprosy.
Can you also find out about plagues, for instance?
Plagues being largely acute diseases, other than the texts, and of course the plague of Athens, you have the texts and Thucydides, and the plague of Justinian, you have the texts of Procopius, and the one in the middle, the plague of the Antonine plague, you've got lots of texts, including that of Galen himself. You've got those accounts, but they sometimes, where you have two accounts of the same plague, they don't add up. But what we're looking for is the skeletal evidence of plagues, mainly looking at deposits. For example, if you've got, and as we remember in Western Crete, the Hanyar, a woman being buried with six children in the same grave, you can assume that, I think rightly, because there's no markers of trauma, that they died of some disease. And we're looking, therefore, for details. And we're looking for plague pits. The problem is, quite frankly, is we can't find them. There's great stories in Procopius of the plague of Justinian and in 6th century of bodies being piled up here and great pits being buried. We find no archaeological evidence for them today.
Now, what about, Bob, just turning to India, because I know you've done quite a lot of recent work in India. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Well, that's a different situation. I got drawn to India about 12, 15 years ago when I went out to the Punjab to work and take control of a charity hospital that had been built by the Sikh community in Birmingham, but they didn't have to run a hospital. I did. So I had to go out there and teach them how to run a hospital. And I used to go out there three or four times a year. And when I was there, I got particularly interested in the archaeology and the medical practices of Northeast India, the Indus civilization existing between 2300 and 1800 BC. And of course, that's a whole lot different simply because we have no texts, plenty of texts, sorry, but nobody's deciphered them. The Indus script is the great world's great last text to be deciphered. And although the colleagues in Helsinki are working hard at it, we've got no results yet. So I'm left purely on archaeology and bones. But the great cities of Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa are so close to the river system of the Punjab that if there are large cemeteries there, they're buried under 100, 150 feet of mud. We will find them one day, but probably not in my lifetime. So I'm resolved to working on skeletons that I find here and there, and which we still do. And of course, looking at the archaeology of the place, and some modern medical experimentation, which I've done looking for the evidence of malaria. And I've recently restarted a project I worked on some years ago for finding the source and the effects of malaria on prehistoric India. And we've come to some rather interesting conclusions.
And I think, isn't this something that you're publishing? Because you've had a number of books that you've published.
Wow, it's an interesting thing. This is the thing I said at the beginning, the effects of COVID. The effects of COVID on academics has been the output of articles and books has risen exponentially by many of them, including myself. Because when you tie down at home, you're sat behind a desk and you are an academic, you tend to use that time to do your research that you've always put on the shelf because you know you're up to your neck in teaching and administration. So the three books I've got in progress are, one is on diseases in the ancient world. It's the papers from a conference I organized in Oxford 2 years ago, and that's ready to come out, series of papers. The other one is disease, the origins of disease and health in the urban world, and it's about disease medicine in the Harappan civilization, a big thick book that is. And the final one is something which I've combined my two great loves of two great civilizations. I've looked for and explained the relationship between Greece and India before Alexander the Great. And that's great fun. And that's actually in print at the moment.
Oh, really excellent. So I'm sure keep an eye on when they're coming out. And sure many of our members will be interested in that. But just before we wind up this interview, what can we learn, or can we learn anything from the archaeologists about pandemics or plagues?
Well,
because here we are in the middle of our own pandemic, and it would be interesting to know.
Well, not a lot, really, in my view, simply because those pandemics, we think one of them is smallpox, we don't know what the other two were. Today, we understand the nature of the disease, we understand the science of the disease, but in the ancient world, they had no concept of the underlying factors of disease. They really only understood the symptoms of disease. But their biggest problems in ancient Athens and ancient Constantinople was the disposal of the dead.
Yes.
So there were huge numbers, and burying them, burying them, sending them off in rafts out into the sea, hope they get lost, and they don't, they wash up another shore and affect another country and that sort of thing.
Well, we're somewhat better than that now.
Yeah, indeed. But the interesting thing is, a man in ancient Greece in the fifth century and a man in Britain in the 21st century, neither of them have any idea where the disease really came from. And we actually think all three diseases of the ancient world came from the East anyway, and probably originated in a part of China.
Well, then there's some similarity there.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
Thank you, Bob, for sharing what is really a brief insight into your very interesting life in this field. I'm sure there'll be many more questions that will be asked by our members, and they'll want to know a little bit more and more detail. So before you go, and it's something I ask all of our people, can you just choose a piece of music that has a special meaning to you?
Yes, I've always been a great lover of Elgar. And there's a piece of Elgar's music which I've always loved, and in fact I voted for with one of my three with Classic FM, is the Dream of Gerontius, particularly the Angel's Farewell at the very end. And for me, it's an expression of my faith. You know, the words were written by Cardinal John Henry Newman of Birmingham, great Brummy in the end. And also, I have got a particular love of one particular version of it. That is the Mahaly Orchestra conducted by Sir John Barbarolli, but the angel being sung, and the only singer that could ever possibly sing it is Dame Janet Baker, and it's The Angel's Farewell. Thank you.